Welcome to the M&A Zing, the show for acquisition entrepreneurs, search funders and holdco builders across the UK and Europe. Each week we dive into the real world stories, strategies and challenges behind building and buying small businesses. Whether you're searching for your first deal or running a group of growing companies, this is your space to learn, share and get inspired. And I'm joined, as ever, by my sagacious co-host, Gareth Hawkins. Gareth, welcome back.
I don't even know what that one means, Alfie. I have to reach for the thesaurus in a first time in a few years.
Yeah, I thought I'd give you a new one every week. Why not?
Thank you. Like word of the day, toilet paper.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, we are primed for a very interesting episode today, which is a topic that we haven't really gone into much detail on before, which is on-market versus off-market search for SMB M&A. This is something that Gareth has been through before on both sides of the aisle. So broker-led on-market listings and proprietary off-market search. And we're going to look into, you know, where you can get the better deals, the trade-off of speed versus value, transactions, relationships, and all the interesting points that are two and four broker-led or proprietary search.
Yeah, there's some nuanced differences. I mean, the deeper you get into this space, the more you realize that you know, all sources of deal flow are not created equally, and you start to be able to kind of navigate the good, the bad, and the ugly, and work out like where your time is best spent, where the attrition rates come. You know, almost like what kind of landmines do you have to avoid stepping on? So hopefully this episode will give listeners a bit more of a primer so they can hit the ground running, particularly those that are starting afresh on their M&A journey. But I think it's probably important to prefix here, Alfie, by sort of, you know, being really open and upfront about the importance of having a blended pipeline, multiple sources coming at you, you know, in parallel. I think if you are all in on one concentrated channel, you've got a heavy dependency, and things are just going to take longer and be arguably more disappointing. So diversification is key, like it is in many walks of this game. So we're going to focus on a bit about proprietary deal flow, and you've done some great previous episodes about that, but perhaps more readily, navigating the different types of brokers that are out there in the market, and where you can find great value, a great additional kind of speed and momentum to your searches, versus where you might get snarled up.
Yeah, absolutely. To go back to your point that you said about a blended search, I think that's a great point. It's something that came up a couple of times during the Serial Acquire Symposium. I sat on a panel and, you know, I was sat next to Charlie, who's a friend of the show and a broker. And I think one of the audience asked, you know, which one is better than the other? And everybody on the panel said the same thing. You know, the whole point is for you to go out there and find the right business for you and to acquire it. And I think that whichever channel, whichever form that takes, is the best way to go. And yeah, I definitely encourage anybody listening who's out there looking to buy their first or second or even third business to look everywhere they can, leave no stone unturned, because the right business for you might need some cold outreach. And if it does, go back to the previous episode Gareth mentioned, but it might just be sat on the books of a broker somewhere, and they might be a great and very helpful broker, and they're going to help you get that deal over the line. So yeah, I would absolutely say to anybody, take a blended approach. What matters is acquiring a business.
Indeed. And of course, there's different strata to this game in terms of deal size and the types of players that are getting involved in those deals. And I guess one of the privileges that we have sitting in the sort of infrastructure space where we are providing these tools to different types of acquirers, lower mid-market private equity through to self-funded searchers and the whole kind of rainbow in between, is that we kind of get to see a bit of trends, and you know, some understand kind of the different sorts of sourcing options available to people depending on the type and size of the deals that they're going for. So whilst this is absolutely no use to the podcast listeners, I thought it might be useful to put a visual up here for our YouTube viewers. And I guess we can link to this in the show notes as well, Alfie.
I was about to say, for anybody listening that can't see it, I will I'll link to this in the show notes, and you'll be able to access it from wherever you listen to your M&A Zing podcast from.
Smashing. So, I mean, we'll not dwell on it for too long, but it's a useful kind of matrix that really sort of tries to summarize how the market is organized by the sort of tiers of types of buyer, types of acquirer, and the kind of deals that they end up getting involved with. So from your kind of opportunist that's working their network to largely do highly contingent seller financed and services for equity deals on kind of lower value and sometimes turnaround style businesses where, you know, there's value to be had, but you've got to really pan for gold there because normally they're neglected or in some kind of peril that makes those sort of deals practical and feasible for the seller, but wouldn't be the immediate value creator that, you know, the larger allocators of other people's funds would be dashing to acquire. Sure. So, you know, you've got the opportunity at the one end of the scale, right the way through to the tier one PE funds at the other end, which are, you know, sourcing from the corporate finance and the investment banking type of representation, the intermediaries, and of course have done a fair trade in taking public companies private. So the thing I wanted to sort of double click on here was around how the multiples grow with those deal sizes. So obviously the higher the profitability and the larger the company, the more mitigated potentially the risks are around the continuity of that business. And so the greater multiples that they can attract, but also, you know, the closer you get to a publicly traded business, the more those public multiples apply. And, you know, a good kind of yardstick, if you like, for a public company is they should be trading at 15 or more times earnings. You know, the waterfall comes down from there in terms of what it looks like at the private markets. But so hopefully this is a useful kind of primer for people looking at this and thinking everything's equal for the first time.
It also really speaks to, last week you talked about the kind of conveyor belt of these deals and kind of picking companies up and putting together roll-ups or growing the companies and then selling them on and the multiples kind of growing. And you can really see that here when you look at this sourcing trends chart that you put together that, again, our listeners can't see, but looking at how those multiples grow, you know, as the business is growing, and again, they go along that conveyor belt. We have our kind of opportunities, our first time as our self-funded searches, picking them up at those between 1 to 4x multiples, growing those and moving them down the line.
Well, if you're looking at our sort of the core of our client base or user base at BizCrunch, we've got the self-funded searches, the independent sponsors, and the search funds. Mm-hmm. Those are pretty much paying between 3 to 6 times earnings, depending on the size of their business, normally from sort of 1 to 4 million in EBITDA. At the top end, they're obviously nudging up against the lower mid-market private equity folks that are coming down that food chain. Because the lower mid-market private equity are sort of adjacent, they're probably willing, if you've put those businesses in good order, to pay you 6 to 8x the multiple, you know. So ultimately, if you're buying in at 3 and selling out at 6, you've made some good money along the way, whilst also growing the underlying EBITDA of the company to get above that threshold. So, you know, the arbitrage can be significant. This is one of the key drivers of that 35%. But just look also how the deal structure varies. You know, you start off at the lower end of the food chain where there's quite a high amount of risk, with a lot of contingency, a lot of deferred, a lot of you know, rollover and basically much more capital efficient transactions that hedge against some of the risk. And then as you go through more of the sort of professional buyers, if we can call them that, the higher the value, the more you're typically getting up front, the less that is being left on the table by way of either conditional earnout or even just deferred consideration, unconditional deferred consideration. And one of the key drivers for that trend is that the professional intermediary advisors are advocating on behalf of, they're working really hard for these sellers to make sure that they don't end up taking deals that are risky to them. So that this is where running a competitive process, bringing a lot of qualified buyers, you know, managing expectations can really score for the seller, because it means a lot less of a complex transaction, a lot less risk that they might not get the deferred or might not get the conditional earnout, and you know, more money up front. So as you work through these crosses in the boxes of the different types of sourcing provider, so everything from the marketplaces, which really only serve the kind of the smaller, and you can see from the nature of marketplaces out there these days, you know, businesses for sale, etc., lots of kebab shops and hot dog vans and, you know, dance schools and that kind of stuff. And that's lovely, but it's not, you know, the mainstay of the market that we're all looking for with, you know, good regular cash flowing asset based businesses. The brokers and the buy side advisors / corporate finance houses, they're typically in that, you know, lower mid market and above, and they're professionalizing these transactions on behalf of the seller. So anyway, I thought useful document to share. One thing to really take away from it as well is just how long this whole bloody process should be taking.
Yes,
be under no illusion.
Yes, that's something I was about to bring up. You can see sort of as you move up the chain, the deals start to actually become quicker. But I guess, again, that just comes down to, like you said, the professionalization. The books are already, nobody's unawares that this is the path that they're on. You know, due diligence is quicker. Negotiations are maybe a little bit faster because the advisor's done some of that work up front.
Yeah, it's exit readiness. This is ultimately what it comes down to is, you know, if you're finding companies off market, you're going to get lower multiples paid. Brilliant. But it is going to take more due diligence, more hand-holding, and probably make more allowances, if you will, for the state of the business because they've not been well prepared by a third party to exit. So often means that you can spend some time cultivating the relationship, get under the hood, do some pre-diligence, have a proper look at these businesses before you start making offers, which is good. Yeah, all that cultivation of the seller is really vital to give them and you equal comfort. But part of that comfort is that they believe that the business is going to a good home and that you might be a good, trustworthy, you know, well-meaning, competent acquirer. And vice versa, you're looking to make sure there aren't any, you know, skeletons hidden under the patio. Any kind of big landmines waiting to go off, in, you know, post acquisition. So that pre-diligence on both sides is actually a real nice byproduct of the off-market process. But it does take time to build that trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's not just the you know, the upper end of the market. This is true when it comes to, you know, the lower and mid-market SMB M&A. That if you're going on market, some of this work will be done up front for you sometimes, and some of that due diligence work is there, and you can get due diligence packs, etc. And again, it makes it a little bit quicker for you, and that's the trade-off, I suppose, with that versus off market, is there is more legwork to put in, but perhaps a better deal to be done.
Oh, totally. Look, if there is a comprehensive information memorandum, a really well put together data room in readiness, you know the sellers are ready to answer the questions, inevitable due diligence questions, look, that's going to get a deal done quicker. Even better if it's a well-structured seller expectation, so the advisors have actually kind of coached them on what they should expect, and that the business is in fit shape to be financeable. So, you know, it's not over-leveraged, it's making good margins, you know, it's at a certain level of materiality on its EBITDA that, you know, the banks and the alternative lenders would like to support. So, you know, if all of that aligns, you can get a deal done reasonably well. And all of that I've mentioned is part of what a good M&A advisor or corporate financier is going to is help these companies prepare through. But as you say, the other end of the spectrum where you're turning over all these rocks and looking for these opportunities and cultivating those relationships, you're going to have to do some of that work. But it will mean that they've not had crazy multiples planted in their head and they're not expecting 100% of the money up front. And so you should be able to get some decent deal structuring and decent value. The upside that you will generate over time is going to be very largely driven by the not overpaying for the deal going in, right?
So sure,
the lower the multiple you pay, the greater the outcome will be for you.
Yeah, and I suppose that, you know, part of the draw of the on market, and the reason that, you know, you're going to get that deal done a little bit quicker is that you've got the intent from the seller, right? And you're not having to, we spoke about this in the last episode, that moving from zero to one. But I do think that it's a good point for us to talk about the different types of brokers, because as you said, it's, you know, whether they've had unrealistic multiples put in their head. We've done buy side breakdowns, Gareth, on this show, where, you know, they're looking at 5, 6, 7 times revenue for a company that doesn't look ready to sell. You know, and I think that can be a problem. Unrealistic seller valuations are cited in 54% of failed sales. You know, and those unrealistic valuations are coming from somewhere. And I think, yeah, it really does speak to the quality of the on-market process and the broker that you're going through.
Yep. Again, with experience, you start to learn who the good brokers are, for want of a better phrase. And, you know, everybody's got their own kind of way of working, and that's to be commended. But they typically fall into sort of a few different divisions or camps. You could probably divide up the UK independent broker market into sort of, you know, I guess, three tranches. Mm-hmm. At one end, you've got your kind of hands-off, almost industrialized, kind of factory-fied, you know, brokers with hundreds of listings, for which they seem more interested in the listing fee than actually getting a deal over the line.
Yes.
To the point that, you know, oftentimes they don't even send a broker per se to accompany a seller on a call. They'll leave the seller and the potential buyer to meet unsupervised, which sort of speaks volumes a bit about how they expect those processes to go and where they're putting their emphasis. So
that's mind-boggling to me that happens.
I'm afraid it does every day. Yeah. So you got those at one end of the spectrum. And at the other end of the spectrum, you've got those very hands-on micromanaging advisors that, you know, will want to control every single part of the conversation, will want to be the point of contact. They won't want to be disintermediated and have you circumnavigate them to go and talk to the sellers. But in controlling that, they'll be the ones that want to write the head to terms. If you get a deal agreed, they'll be the ones that will keep trying to cheese pair on the deal structure. So they'll keep on pushing. They'll try and decouple it from, you know, multiples, for example, get you to fixed high valuations. They'll try to really stack the deck in favor of the seller. And that's their job. But often that is like, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, you don't want to keep getting squeezed until the deal no longer makes sense. And yeah. And some brokers, some representatives get a little bit over their skis on that one. So there is this... Go ahead.
Deal fatigue is a real thing. You know, I speak to people all the time that have been through that process, and it sort of draws the life out of it for them. And yeah, if a deal takes too long, people walk away.
It kills it for both parties. You know, there are intermediaries and professional advisors throughout the transaction, you know, from the beginning to the end. And you wheel the lawyers in, and, you know, they've got the best intentions, but they will add time, complexity, and cost to the transaction. And that's after having navigated the time, complexity, and cost that the brokers have created for you. So you've really got to have some thick skin, some tenacity, some persistence, but also not get deal fever and get worked over by some of this opportunism that takes place amongst these micromanaging intermediaries to really, you know, under the veil of best serving their client, they're obviously pushing their consideration, what they can get out of it, because their fees are normally contingent on success, right? So,
sure.
So yes, it's just deal fatigue comes often from those kind of places, and so many deals get walked away from by one or both of the parties because of that. So need to be very cautious and set some ground rules going in. And as I've said on previous episodes, you know, manage expectations around target completion dates and what is material, and keep a line of communication going with the sellers so that you can pick the phone up and say, should we try and shortcut this? You know, can we keep this sensible? But not always possible. To that point, somewhere in the middle of those two extremes of the hands off and the hands on are the kind of light touch, more pragmatic, more biased for action, more biased for outcome amongst them. And there's a good number of those. They're typically independent. They're typically experienced, but grounded, down to earth, and know exactly when to add value and when to step out of the way and let, you know, the nature take its course, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah.
So those are the ones that I think, you know, the market's got huge respect for and that really add value. They do individually small numbers of deals a year, but really care about those deals that they do individually, and understand the businesses that they're representing, and will keep momentum around a deal wherever they can, mm-hmm. because they want it to complete. And that will have managed expectations well on both sides. And I think that's a recipe for success that we see often. It's the other extremes that tend to be where there's a wake of dead bodies, if you will, dead deals.
Yeah, deals, not bodies, hopefully. Deals haven't gone that far wrong. Do you think then there's a sort of Goldilocks zone between those two extremes of sort of volume? Because you've got the big corporate sort of factory farmed, listings sites, more than sort of broker sites, really, and they've got huge volume, and lots of those companies don't move. You see the same companies on there sort of month in, month out, and then, you know, those that are micromanaging probably have very few that go through because they are so deeply involved in it. Do you think there's kind of light touch in the middle? They have there's a quicker pace of deals going through those, but not so much volume that they obviously don't have as much time to put thought and sort of care into them.
Yes, I think there is that volume. There's also a correlation with fees, I'd imagine, as well. You know, those kind of the bottom end of the corporate finance type operations that are representing deals that require an element of sophistication, but still in that lower market, they are doing a small number of deals, but at a high margin, a high success fee. Okay. And it's very much worth their while to sit all over it and, you know, watch it like a hawk and manage every element of it. To that end, they probably only have a couple of deals on their particular desk at any given time that they're managing. Whereas, as you say, the ones in that Goldilocks zone, that sweet spot, have got a few, but they've charged a fair price to get that far, and they've got a fair fee on success, but enough to motivate them, but not enough for them to just, go all in on one deal.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes sense. Maybe that's something to look at if you are exploring brokers and that is something that you're looking into and you don't really know where to look. That might be a good sort of jump off point.
Yes. But I mean, look, brokers and listing sites, et cetera, they're a necessary part, as I've said earlier in this episode. But what is fascinating is reading sort of different reports that buyers are increasingly becoming frustrated by the sort of low level of listed sellers that are actually out there. And you know, you have to kiss an awful lot of frogs. We said this last time around. But there's a lot of lipsticks on pigs. if I'm not, you know, going too far around the animal kingdom with this, but there's a lot of dressing up goes on. Mm-hmm. And, unpicking that is a time-consuming exercise in and of itself. Mm-hmm. So being able to get straight to the heart of the matter and do your own diligence and make your own kind of informed assessment of what the condition of a business is that is afforded to you by the off-market search process is really valuable. With a broker and with a listing site, you can get to conversations sooner, but the negotiations can be much more protracted and the navigating the bullshit can be more complicated. Whereas it might take longer to get to a sensible, you know, deal structuring conversation with a seller off market from all that relationship cultivation. But when you do, you can have much more of a frank and maybe almost open and transparent type of conversation.
Mm. Yeah. So you can't polish a turd, but you can roll it in glitter. So do you want to get there before the glitter goes on, or do you want to pick the glitter off yourself?
My God. Yeah. Okay. Well, there's a very visceral mental image to work with.
But you're absolutely right. That is the case. It's, you know, do you want to put the mileage in and, you know, get there before, like you said, there's been any sort of bullshit applied and nobody's had a chance to get in between and build a deal on terms that suit both of you. And there is a lot more work to be done. Again, you know, we work with off-market searches all the time, and it is a long process. It does take time. And it's just, maybe it speaks to the type of searcher you are as to which route you go down. You know, whether you do kind of look for both, and it's whether the right kind of company pops up in an on-market search, whether you are adamant that you want to, you know, find a sort of hidden gem and go down off-market only, or whether, you know, and there are some searchers out there, and it's not disparaging to them at all, that probably wouldn't want to do the off-market process and aren't suited to it and are best off navigating the BS that sometimes comes with an on-market deal, and but just getting the deal done a bit quicker, and maybe going through, you know, a year or two of the off-market thing would never happen for them, and it's best they just complete it however they can.
Yes. I think when you've been in the market 6 months looking for opportunities, you realize just how concentrated those opportunities are and how competed those opportunities are. You know, when you find a good lower mid market deal that is suitable for kind of traditional search funds, independent sponsors, that hasn't got a lot of hair on it, that actually survives the financial and commercial due diligence and is fundable and is available at a sensible multiple, like, you know, there's a small number of them at any given time. It's quite concentrated. And I, you know, there's not a week goes by now that I don't speak to a few searchers that are all asking about often the same new deal that's come onto the market this week.
Really? That's interesting.
Yes. It's interesting one to navigate. And I try and be as supportive to each as I can without betraying any confidence, obviously. But yeah, you know, we've had several examples of where searchers have been going for the same deal. And sometimes that's, you know, time for the broker to rub their hands.
I was going to say, what happens in that situation? Does it become a sort of a bit of a bidding war at times?
I mean, if the micromanaging broker has anything to do with it, yes. Right. You know, they're doing their job, but yes, there is an element of running that competitive process to try and push the multiple up as far as possible and bring the deal structure as front loaded as they can. That is not to the searcher's benefit, and often leads again to deals kind of tapping out because actually what was agreed at heads just doesn't survive due diligence because everybody got a bit, you know, feverish about it. So yeah, it does have exactly that effect, I'm afraid. Often, well, sometimes without justification.
It's super interesting. I mean, obviously our show, is more heavily geared towards searchers, but this is good if you are a seller and you are listening. It just does show the benefit of solid exit readiness, because if you have got everything in order and you are an attractive business and you go out to market and there are a dearth of good opportunities out there for searchers, you might be the subject of a bidding war.
Yeah, it's the seller's dream, right? But it has to be grounded in reality of what multiples are really paid for these businesses at these different sizes. And you know, the premiums, if there is a premium at the heads of terms, it might unravel by the time you get to the SPA. You know, there's lots of retrading that goes on in these competitive processes. You know, some buyers know that they need to, you know, overdo it to stand out, but then undo it when they have got the exclusivity period and they can start to kind of unpick the valuation. So, you know, the market forces will determine.
Yeah. And I suppose it's that's a tough one for a seller to take, because I suppose, you know, they've maybe started counting that money in their heads already. And if you start sort of backpedaling on that as, and for justified reasons, potentially, as you know, the due diligence goes on, that's going to make that deal falling apart all the more likely, I imagine.
I'm afraid so, yeah. But common sense has to prevail. And so the experienced brokers know that. They know what the business is likely to get a deal over line at, and they don't create a toppy kind of bidding war too zealously, because they'll have a higher risk of deal failure?
Okay, so we have covered sourcing trends by buyer types. We've looked at speed versus value. We've looked at transaction versus relationship and the sort of types of brokers that are out there. Is there anything else that you think that an acquirer sort of navigating this on and off market comparison really needs to know before they decide to sort of jump feet first into either?
I think I'll just go back to my original point. You need to not be all in on one channel. You need to cultivate the relationships with the good brokers, those kind of Goldilocks zone, bias for action, light touch brokers that can bring you good deal opportunities. You're not entirely dependent on them. So you have a kind of panel of them, if you will, that you can go to. I think buy side advisors are quite useful at a certain level of the market, where almost like in the American realtor sense, where you've got, you know, someone advocating and going out and finding the opportunities and triaging those opportunities before you have to spend your time on them. Mm-hmm. They can be really useful, but at a certain level. And I see an increasing number of those entering the market, and I think there's real value there. But do all of that in parallel with an off-market funnel and an off-market process. You know, set up your automations and look for all of the little seller intent signals about whether they're reading your copy and whether they're visiting your website, and do everything that you can to chase them down and have a sensible conversation. Don't be disheartened if the timing isn't right for them because you've hit them out of the blue. But you know, how you then manage that keeping in touch process and that sort of cultivation is vital to actually get a deal done eventually. But don't underestimate that whilst in this day and age, you should be able to get to conversations within a few months, getting over the line to a deal is still a year-long process.
Absolutely. And that goes back to your initial point about having multiple channels. Is the searches that I see that are most successful are the ones that often have the best deal flow. And you have to kind of keep that going. I've worked with people before that have got to heads of terms and stopped doing all other types of searches, and then the deal falls apart and they're back to square one and they have to start searching and sending out emails and talking to brokers all over again, and they've set them back. So I've set themselves back, you know, 3-6 months. So yeah, I think having multiple channels and keeping those channels going, because yeah, you never know how long the deal's going to take to get over the line. There's lots of reasons why deals fall apart. And I think, yeah, like you said, it's about tenacity, and you combine that tenacity with good deal flow and you'll be one of those sellers that does get it over the line and does generate some returns.
Exactly that. So a good mix of off-market proprietary deal flow and on-market verified opportunities. If you can come up with those two, you'll have plenty of options.
Excellent. Right, well, I think that's all we've got time for this week. But thank you, everybody, for listening. Please leave us any comments on LinkedIn, YouTube, wherever you get your podcast from. If there's anything that you'd like us to cover in the future, if you've got any questions for us about on or off market deal flow, we are, as we said in our last episode, about to launch seller verified listings on BizCrunch. So you can look at any engaged opportunities while you are doing your off market search. And again, like we said, we advocate for a blended approach. And that's one of the reasons why we brought that on platform for you. So keep your eyes peeled for that. If you're an existing BizCrunch user, you'll see that very soon. And we are also very soon to launch the BizCrunch VDR. And if you want a sneak peek of that, then please send us a message. I'll be happy to give you a quick tour.
Great stuff. Exciting times.
Yes, very exciting times. It's all to help the search community in the UK get more deals over the line. That's what we're enthused about, and that's what we're building for every day. And that's why we do this podcast, and you know, the events and the meetups and the incubators and everything we do is all driving in that direction. So every time we release a new feature that helps people get that done, I'm ecstatic.
Likewise. All right. Until next time, then, folks, keep on crunching.
Keep on crunching.